This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This is a Midrash Rabbah at the end of the Sedra. Davar acher, lama la shamayim vela aretz? Why does Moshe address himself to heaven and to earth? The Midrash has been discussing why ha'azinu shamayim v'aretz, why listen heaven and earth. Amar Rabbi Chanina, lama adavar domeh, said Rabbi Chanina, what can this be compared to? Le'echad shifkid pikadon etzelo havo. A man gave a precious object to his friend for safekeeping. Meit ohavo, shifkid et ha'pikadon etzelo. This nifka, the one who was holding the precious pikadon, died. Omad beno shel oiso shehifkid ha'pikadon. Sorry, it was the mafkid who died, the one who gave, the owner of the precious possession. Omad beno shel oiso shehifkid ha'pikadon. The son, the heir, got up. V'haya mechabed loiso shehifkid ha'pikadon etzelo mechabed lishto. And he started becoming very nice and courteous to the man who had the pikadon and to his wife. So I deposit my gold bars in a Swiss bank, and a man deposits his gold bars in a Swiss bank, and the man dies, and the son goes over and he takes gifts to the Swiss banker and gifts to the Swiss banker's wife and everyone. Amru lo lama ata mechabed shnei. So people start saying to him, no, you know, you're flattering the Swiss banker. Understand, you want him to look after your account properly. But why are you flattering his wife? What's she got to do with it? Sure, it's not because we don't like to flatter the wives, just because in this case there was no reason to flatter the wife. So they said to he said to them, Pikodun Yeshli Yetzlam, I've deposited an object by them, the Ena Beruruli Etzlamihu Apikodun. I'm not sure exactly who's holding it. I know my father gave them a Pikodun. Do I know who's running the account there? If it's the banker or the banker's wife, imetzlo imetzlishto. I don't know who's in charge. They're both involved. Then it might be either of them. Kol hechan shepikdoni munach sheyeh shomer yofe. Obviously, he doesn't want to go inquiring otherwise because that's discourteous. So this is wherever it is, let it be. So what's it costing me to be nice to an extra person? At least my safekeeping will be kept safe and will be kept in good order. Kach amar leila Moshe, amru leila Moshe. So they said to Moshe as well. Lamo atom etzave l'shamayim v'la'aretz. Why are you addressing heaven and earth? Are you a spiritual man and address heaven? You're a physical man, address earth. But what's this addressing heaven and earth? Omar lahem ani osid lomus. Says to them, I'm going to die. Ve'eini yodea, don't forget this is on the day of his death actually. Ve'eini yodea l'heicha nafshi holeches. And I don't know where my nefesh is going to land up. Im l'shamayim im la'aretz. I don't know if it's going to land up in heaven or on earth. So I'm addressing myself to both of them. Wherever my nefesh lands up resting, it should be looked after well. So God said to him, no creature is going to have any control over your nefesh. Where is it going to land up? It'll land up right under my throne, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's where your nefesh will be. Not in Shemayim, not in Oretz. It has a special place. This is a very frightening midrash. Moshe Rabbeinu, who was a tzaddik like one can't imagine, he is the epitome to us of a man who reached the highest levels that it is capable for a human being to reach. At the age of 80, the Ribbono Shel Olam imposes upon him the leadership of the Jewish people, and he tries to decline it. He doesn't want it. He wants to retire. Ribbono Shel Olam says, no ways. You've got a 40-year contract and I want it fulfilled. You've got to take these people. And he takes the people out of Egypt. And he puts up with all their suffering and with all their nonsense. And he raises them out of the depths of slavery and misery to the elated heights of Har Sinai. In 49 days he does it. What a teacher he must have been. To have taken those people, those Avodim, out of Mitzrayim and prepared them for Matan Torah in 49 days. And then he gives them the Torah. And then he teaches them the whole Torah. And he puts up with their complaining and with their arguing and with everything. One thing he does wrong, reported in the Torah. A couple of minor things. But the one major thing that he does wrong, he hits the rock instead of talking to the rock. and the yisurim, the pain and suffering as a result of that. We talked about kapora early on, paying for your averas. How Moshe Rabbeinu had to pay for that avera. He wasn't allowed into Eretz Yisrael. The one ambition of his life, to get into Eretz Yisrael with his people, to lead his people ultimately into Eretz Yisrael, and to see them settled in their own land, that's denied him. That you can't have. And he's now about to die. He's done tshuva for that avera. He's done tshuva for any avera he might have committed. He's about to die for his averas. What's he worried about? Moshe Rabbeinu is worried whether he's going to go to heaven or not. And what about us? It's the most frightening thing. Moshe Rabbeinu stands on the day of his death and addresses Shemayim Voritz because he doesn't know if he's going to land up in Shemayim or in Oritz. In Bereshis, in chapter 32, we have a similar concept where Yaakov's on his way back and he hears that Esav's coming out to meet him. And it says in verse 8, Vayiro Yaakov Me'od Vayitzelo, and Yaakov was very worried, very afraid, and he became worried. So the Mefoshim asked, what's he afraid about? The Ribbono Shel Olam has promised him, don't worry Yaakov, you'll go in peace and you'll come back in peace, there's no problem, everything will be alright. Says the Ibn Ezra, Yodanu ki kol oven koton v'godol keneged ha'ose. The greatness or smallness of an avera depends on the greatness or smallness on the person committing the avera. If you do something wrong, how bad it is depends on how good you are. The better you are, the worse a small avera is. Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu does a little thing, he strikes the rock instead of speaking to the rock. For him, that's a big thing. If we would have done it, the Ribbono Shel Olam would have probably have turned the blind eye. Not the end of the world. We do worse things every day. But for Moshe Rabbeinu, that was a big thing. The Yaakov pochad shema choto, and Yaakov was afraid in case he sinned, or shogog b'machshavtoi, or he thought something incorrect. Uvavu then, because of that, lo yehei Hashem imo, the Ribbono Shel Olam will no longer be with him. This is a man who's been promised special attention by the Ribbono Shel Olam. Apart from normal siyata d'shmaya, he's going to get special attention in making sure that he comes back safely. He's afraid maybe he's done something wrong. This is the same Yaakov who declares at the same point, in Lavan Garti, I'd stayed with Lavan of all people, that crook and that rogue and that rosha, the Tariag mitzvah shamati, and I kept all of the 613 mitzvahs, every one of them, the mitzvahs Asay, the mitzvahs Lot Asay, the lot. So how does that tie up with here? If you kept the Tariag mitzvahs, what are you afraid about that you did an avera? Furthermore, if you are afraid that you did an avera, so do tshuva. There's a way of handling it. If you're afraid that you did an avera, you can do tshuva, you can repent. The same applies to Moshe. What are you standing Moshe on the day of your death and you say, I don't know if I'm going to heaven or to earth? Do tshuva. So plead with the Ribbono Shel Olam that if you've done anything wrong, you should be mechaper you, and you should be moichel you, and soleach you, and you should land up in Shemayim. But there seems to be something here that they're worried about. Both in the case of Yaakov and in the case of Moshe, there seems to be something they're worried about for which you can't do tshuva. We've got to understand what it is. What is it that brings a person to do an avera? A man knows that something's wrong. Let's look at the various types. There's an oynes. A man does it for reasons beyond his control. An oynes, it can happen. That's one kind of avera. Then there's a shoigeg. So for an oynes, you need kapora, you need tshuva, but okay, it's not terribly serious. Oynes rachmane patre. The Torah lets off a man who's in a situation of onus. The next one is shoigeg. You made a mistake. You didn't know it was Shabbos. You didn't know this was forbidden, whatever it is. So for shoigeg, it's quite serious already. Even doing an avera by mistake, you're held responsible. And you need tshuva. And you need to bring a korban. And you'd have to do all sorts of things for an avera that you've done by shoigeg. That's understandable. Then there's mezid. A man knows it's awesome, but he does it. What do you mean he knows it's also that he does it? If he knows it's also, why does he do it? What is the psychology of sin? What's the psychology of avera? The Gemara says, "En adam chayta elam kein nichnas bo ruach shtus." A person doesn't do an avera unless he goes mad a little bit. You've got to be meshuga to do an avera. If you know it's an avera, you've got to be meshuga. There's got to be something wrong with you. Now, what I want to analyze is what is it that's wrong with you? What goes wrong with a person? Where does he break down when he does an avera? We're talking about people who've learnt a little bit and who believe. And they believe that all sorts of terrible things happen to you if you do an avera. Where is the breakdown? Now, in Shavuos, in Gemara Shavuos, Daf Hey Amud Aleph, 5a, the Gemara discusses various degrees of Shoigeg and comes out with a concept called Yediyas Beis Rabbi. They're deciding how much do you have to know for it to be a Shoigeg. To have done an Avera by mistake. You can't say you knew nothing, because that's onus really, if you knew nothing. So Shoigeg is somehow that you knew but you didn't know. What exactly is a Shoigeg? And they discussed the concept of Yediyas Beis Rabbi, knowledge from the house of your Rebbe. What does that mean? Says Rashi. This is incredible. It means Shelomad Beveis Rabbi Shehanogea Betuma Tome. You learnt in the house of your Rebbe, in other words, you learnt in the Beis HaMedrash a din, that if a man touches something which is Tome, for example, a sheret, this is talking in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you touch an animal which is Tome, then you become Tome. You learnt that in the Beis HaMedrash. You learnt the whole psychology of Avera. This is incredible. What Rashi says is the following. There are three aspects to knowledge, and usually an Avera B'mezid is missing one of them. The one aspect to knowledge is to know the din. You've got to know the din before you can be a Jew. You've got to know what you can do and what you can't do. He knows. He's learned. The second thing you've got to know is that you're doing it consciously. If you put on a light on Shabbos completely unconsciously, you leant against the wall and the light switch flicked and the light went on, that's not shogeg even. That's onus. It's not a conscious act. So your action must be conscious as well. Now, if you know the din and your action is conscious, surely that's a mezid, surely that's a deliberate avera, and it's not a shoigeg. Says the Gemara, no, that can still be a shoigeg. What you didn't realize is, shenitma, that it's affected you. That's an incredible thing. You disassociate yourself from the avera. You know that wrong has been done, and you know that you have done the wrong, but you're not affected by it. That's it. And Rashi uses some interesting words. Rashi says, His boynein is intellectual application of an intense degree. That means he was not intellectually involved in order to feel emotionally that I have been defiled by this action. That the Gemara wants to say is a shogeg. That's an incredible thing, you know. People do that all the time. We do it when we drive. It says no overtaking. That's written. That's for everybody else. I'll be careful when I overtake. But it's made for idiots like you who'll be careful when they overtake. Nobody's going to overtake not being careful on a dangerous point. But the law was designed for the fools like you. No, but it doesn't apply to me. And those are the people that get killed. No, you're doing it all the time. Whatever it is, it says. One learns the halacha and one understands that there's nobody envisages themselves in Gehenna. You ever thought of yourself burning in hot oil in Gehenna? You always think of the other guy burning in hot oil in Gehenna, and you're watching. Or at the very best, if you can manage to get yourself to the feet, to the point, you split yourself in two and you're watching yourself burning in Gehenna. But it's really your Yetzirah that you're watching in your imagination. You don't really expect yourself to ever be in that position. And the Zohar in fact says that nobody expects to die. People strut around the world, says the Zohar, as if the place belongs to them and as if they're here forever. But everybody knows they're going to die. But lo his boyanein losu malibo. People don't conceptualize it to the point where they actually feel it. And again, if you feel you're going to die, you don't feel yourself dead. You just feel what it's going to be like without you. And how your kids are going to manage, and how your wife is going to manage, and how everyone's going to manage. You know that there's going to be a time. Intellectually, you know that you're not here forever. But you don't feel yourself that you're really going to die. It's just one of those things that a human being doesn't feel. These things don't apply to us. And when I ask people to phone up and give their names and addresses so that if I have to cancel a shir, then I know who to get hold of. Some people do it, and some people forget to do it, and most people say it doesn't apply to me. He knows my name and address. That's how it is. We constantly do it, but we exclude ourselves. It's part of our gaiva, it's part of our arrogance, not to feel that we're part of the klal, that we're part of the tzibur, and the Torah was given to us. It's always talking about somebody else. I have two kinds of people in the shir. There are those people that whatever I say, they think I'm talking about them. And it's very hard because they feel very sensitive. And I've always got to be very careful, because whatever I say, they think I'm talking about them, and they phone me afterwards, or they come and see me afterwards, and they feel very upset. They're sensitive people. But rather that than the other kind of person, whatever I say, they think I'm talking about the other guy. There's got to be some way, there's got to be a medium where one understands when it applies to oneself, when it doesn't apply to oneself, when it applies to everybody, including oneself. But the ability to disassociate ourselves from the things we're learning is an ability which is the cause of Avera B'Shoge. That's how we cause these Averas. When one realizes the extent of this, that means that we don't appreciate that doing an Avera defiles us. If we would appreciate that doing the Avera defiles us, we wouldn't do it. There's a story in the Yerushalmi, in Brochus, where the Yerushalmi talks about the fact that they once instituted a din that a man, after having had any form of sexual relationship, had to go to the mikveh before he was allowed to daven or to learn. That din has subsequently been withdrawn, but there was a time when that din existed, and the Yerushalmi is discussing why and the purpose of it. And it says one of the reasons is it's to keep people away from Avera. Now that's amazing. How does this keep people away from Avera? So the Yerushalmi tells a story that actually occurred. There was a Shomer Kromim, there was a man who was a guard of a vineyard. He was a farmer. And he was obviously a Yid, a Shomer Torah Mitzvahs. Frum fellow, obviously, as you'll see from the continuation of the story. But it so happens that a very beautiful lady came to visit the vineyard. And there was nobody else around. And he was quite taken with this lady. And he propositioned her. Now she's in a difficult position. What does she do, says the Yerushalmi? To run away, he'll outrun her. To start reasoning with him, he's a Talmud Chacham and she's not. And he'll beat her in any kind of argument. What's she going to do? Fight with him? There's no way she can win. So she decides on a side attack. She says to him, Reikon, you empty so-and-so. And then you're going to go and learn Torah? Is there a mikveh anywhere near here that you can go to the mikveh before you go and learn? And he says, yes, you're right. And the Yerushalmi tells how he goes looking around for a mikveh, and by the time he goes and he finds the mikveh, she's gone away and he's forgotten about her and it's all over. But do you realize what the story is? This man is worried about chas v'sholom, that he should learn without having been to the mikveh. Chas v'sholom? Never. But Eishes Ish, he's going to have relationships with another man's wife? What does he do about that? And then he's going to go and learn Torah. That means if he had a mikveh nearby, he would have had no compunction in having relationships with another man's wife, dipping himself in the mikveh and sitting down in the base of Medrash and learning. What's he going to learn? The same Torah that says thou shalt not. How do you explain that? Doesn't apply to me. All sorts of reasons why it doesn't apply to me. The fact is, emotionally, he disassociates himself from the base of Medrash. He's learning, then he's learning. When he's outside, he's outside. What was the tragedy of the Lithuanian Jews who came out to this country? Lamdonim, people who could learn, frum people, came and he saw him. What about Shabbos? What about Kashrus? There was nothing here. Shabbos doesn't apply in South Africa. That's how they reasoned. You know, the Torah was given, nobody thought of South Africa, when there was absolutely nothing. Shabbos, it's just impractical Shabbos here. We'll make a bit of money, and then we'll start keeping Shabbos again. We'll establish places that other people can come and keep Shabbos. But at the moment, Shabbos doesn't apply. And if they didn't say that intellectually, they said it emotionally. They placed a barrier between their learning and their actions. And they split their personalities into two. That, says Rashi, is the sickness. And in fact, then, the meaning of the Gemara is true. A person doesn't sin unless he goes mad. What form of madness? Schizophrenia. That's it. Completely split yourself, and you have your religious life and you have your practical life, and the two don't meet at all. That's the source of Avera. To take this concept of Avera one step further, there's a Gemara in Beitzo on Daf Yud Zayin on the base, 17b, where the Gemara is discussing the question of if you did cook on Shabbos by mistake, can you eat what you've cooked? Well, that's what the Gemara is discussing, and it's bringing various proofs. Now it brings the following proof. Brings a proof from the case of Erev Tavshirin. What is the case of Erev Tavshirin? If Shabbos falls, if Yom Tov falls on a Sunday, sorry, if Yom Tov falls on a Friday, then you make Erev Tavshilin before, on the Thursday in Eretz Yisrael, or on the Wednesday here. Erev Tavshilin then allows you to cook on Friday for Shabbos. Normally, although you're allowed to cook on Yom Tov, it's only for the day itself, but you can't cook for the next day. Erev Tavshilin, what happens is you start cooking on Wednesday, and you say, I'm starting my cooking now, and I'm cooking for Shabbos, and I would like to continue that cooking during Yom Tov. Then the din is im hotir, hotir le Shabbos. If you've left over some cooking, then you can leave it over for Shabbos. Uvivad shelo yarim, provided you don't crook. Ve'im herim osu, and if you did crook, then you can't do it. In other words, sorry, just one moment here. What we're talking about here is a case where he ate his Erev Tavshilin, right? So came Friday morning, he ate the Erev Tavshilin, and then he suddenly realized that he hasn't cooked yet for Shabbos. So he says, oi, I'll tell you what, I'm going to cook for the visitors that are going to come this afternoon. He's allowed to do that, and if there's anything left over, he can use that on Shabbos. That's the din. The Vivat Shelo Yarim, what does it mean, Shelo Yarim? To cook specially more than he needs, so that he should have something left over for Shabbos. That you're not allowed to do. So the Gemara wants to prove from here the inherim osu. And if you did, that means you've now cooked, you're expecting 5 visitors, so you cook for 10 visitors, and you eat the rest for Shabbos. Also, you're not allowed to use that food. Therefore, the Gemara wants to prove that if you do cook when you're not supposed to cook on a Shabbos or a Yom Tov, you're not allowed to eat the results of your cooking. Answers the Gemara, Omar Ashi, Ha'aroma Ka'amri. So you're bringing me a proof from somebody who's crooked. Shani Ha'aroma. When you crook, the Rabbonin regard it even more severe than mezid, even more severe than doing it deliberately. Let's understand why. Says Rashi, and this also is an incredible Rashi. La'olam, says Rashi, I might say ovar ve'ofo mutar. I might say that if you baked and cooked on Shabbos by mistake, you're allowed to eat it. V'haroma, but you've just brought me a proof from the din that if you've made extra for visitors more than you should have, that you're not allowed to eat that extra. Ein araya, that's no proof lekan. The shiny ha'aroma mezid, because ha'aroma is completely different from mezid. So we have here another kind of avero. We talked about ones, shoigeg, mezid. Now there's something more severe even than mezid, that's ha'aroma. Doing it in a way which appears mutter, which appears permissible, but is in fact forbidden. Why? The ikar lemeimar achmu barabonin b'haroma tfei mimezid, because one can easily say that the rabbis were more severe on somebody who committed an isur b'haroma with crooking more than mezid. The ilu mezid roshahu la'avor al divrei chachamim. If you do it b'mezid, that means you know it's not allowed to be done, but you do it. You're a rosha. You're wicked. Ve'ein acherim lemeidim heimena, and nobody else is going to learn from you. You're labeled a rosha, and everybody knows you're a Rosho, and that's it. Nobody has anything to do. And he too one day might well do tshuva. He might well repent, work out that he's been doing wrong, and he'll do tshuva. So he doesn't undermine the whole principle of an Erev. Although he doesn't keep the Erev Tavshilin, although he cooks without an Erev Tavshilin, knowingly and deliberately, he's not undermining the principle of Erev Tavshilin. Because others won't learn from him, and he himself might one day do tshuva. Avar marim, but a person who's dishonest, sovu lasos beheter, he thinks he's doing it beheter. Hilkach lo yoshu v'libo lachzovo. So he's never ever going to do tshuva, v'acherim lemeidin heimenu, and other people learn from him and copy him. Umi akra toras eruv. And therefore you'll find that the whole concept of eruv tavshilim becomes misused and abused. And that we can't allow. Therefore this is even worse than mezid. You have an incredible Rashi here. Rashi is saying, up till now we've thought that the worst form of Avera is Mezid. A man who knows that it's wrong to do it and knows that he's doing it, and yet he does it. And thought that that's the worst. Says the Gemara here, as Rashi explains it, no, there's one worse. Ha'aroma. When you think you're doing right. Asks my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, that's all. Either way, if he is expecting Orchim, if he is expecting, if he's expecting guests, then there's no haram, he's not crooking, even if they didn't turn up. if he's not expecting guests, if he knows that they're really not coming, then it's mazid. It's not harama. You know, it's not crooking. It's mazid. He's doing it deliberately. Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, who's he crooking? Himself. He's talked himself into believing that visitors will come. So he thinks there's really nothing wrong with what he's doing. He's talked himself into believing, just like the Chazon Ish we had this afternoon. The business of adding paraffin to the candle to keep it burning because the visitor's coming after all. He convinces himself that it's important to do this because visitors are coming. Really, they're not coming, and he's distorted the thing in his own mind. What we see from here is that this ha'aroma, this dishonesty, which really is the function of the Rashi I brought you earlier from the Gemara in Shavuos, that is, where a man doesn't link his own defilement with his performance of an Aveira. I mean, that's really dishonest, basically. It's intellectual dishonesty. You sit and learn in the base of Medrash, but you don't keep it. You think it doesn't apply to you. That's the dishonesty we're talking about. You talk yourself out of the Aveira, or rather, you talk yourself into the Aveira. What we're saying now is that that's even worse than amazing. That's even worse than doing it deliberately. Why? Because you'll never do tshuva. Now we understand that Ibn Ezra in Bereshis with Yaakov. Says the Ibn Ezra, he's worried about a little Aveira. What kind of Aveira? She'enachoto oy shogog b'machshavtoy, an intellectual mistake. Wasn't worried about doing something knowingly wrong. He knows that there's nothing which is done. In Lovan, garti v'taryag mitzvah shamati. I've been with Lovan and I've kept the 613 mitzvahs. There's nothing I've knowingly done wrong. But who knows what I might have done unknowingly. In what sense? In an incorrect thought. In working a thing out incorrectly. In being more a heter, in allowing myself a heter where maybe there isn't a heter. In dishonest thinking, in thinking which is not accurate. In intellectual integrity, maybe that's where I've slipped up somewhere. And if that's where I've slipped up somewhere, says Yaakov, I can't do tshuva because I don't even know about it. One of the principles of tshuva is azivas hachet, as we learned this afternoon. You've got to leave the avera. But if you don't even know that you've done the Avera, how can you leave it? So it's impossible to do tshuva. Yaakov is worried. Despite the fact that I've kept the Tariag mitzvahs, maybe there are things which I've done which haven't been 100% right. It's a little bit difficult to say that this is what Moshe is worried about. Moshe Rabbeinu, after all. Although we have a source for it already now with Yaakov. But let's look for a moment at the situation of mitzvah saseh, of positive mitzvahs. The Gemara says in Nida, Daf Lamed, I think it is, that there no time does a human being have such ecstasy as when he's in the womb of his mother. And that's when everything's laid on. He doesn't have to worry about his food and his drink and his sleep. It's all done automatically for him. And he's even taught the whole Torah. He knows the whole Torah from beginning to end. What has he done to deserve this knowledge? What has he done to deserve the knowledge of the Torah? Nothing. So why does he get it? Because that's really the natural state of a human being. A human being should be somebody who knows the whole Torah. When Adam Harishon was born, he knew the whole Torah. He was born with the Torah, the same as you're born with hands and legs and a head and a brain and ears. You're born with knowledge, with the whole Torah. That, says the Gemara, an angel comes and makes him forget it as the child is born. Why does he do that? Why go and spoil it? Because the essence of this world is doing it yourself. That's what this world is all about. Doing it yourself. Yegiyah. Toiling to do it yourself. Applying yourself. Effort to do it yourself. I was talking to two people recently. One is a big gambler, and the other one is not a gambler at all. Now we're together. The three of us were together. So the gambler was saying to the non-gambler, you miser, you never put a penny on a Why do you do it? He says, it's a function of generosity. Money comes, money goes, you spend, I give money, I give charity, I give my wife, I give my children, I gamble. Money passes through me easily. I'm not a miser, that's why I do it. Sounded like quite a righteous thing to do, to gamble. So I said to the other man, why don't you gamble? He said, I've worked too hard for my money. I don't give a penny away. He said, he's absolutely right, I'm a miser. I don't give my wife enough money, I don't give my children enough money, I don't give enough charity. I said, but it's because I've worked too hard for it. I've been without it, I've had poverty, and I've worked and I've slaved for what I've got.
and I'm not giving it away on any gambling table.
What do we see here? That the degree of effort determines the degree of ownership. The more you've worked for something, and the more you've slaved for something, the more it's yours. And it's quite right. People who are born with money are naturally more generous with money. And people who have worked it for it themselves are usually quite tight, difficult to part with it. That's a little bit of a misuse of the concept of tight ownership, that the more you work for it, the more you own it. But we'll see the correct use of the concept in a moment. And that's how it is. Something that you can hear a wonderful chiddush in Torah, but you heard it without applying yourself. You were just sitting and somebody told it to you, and you can be sure that a few weeks later you've forgotten it. Why? No effort. You acquired it without effort. If it's something you've worked on and you've slaved on and you've sweated on, you don't forget it so easily. It sticks around. So the whole function of this world is do it yourself. Make things yours. That's what's important. Things should affect you. They should become yours. Why do we have to do the mitzvahs? Not just because the mitzvahs have to be done. God could have created the world with the mitzvahs already done. The same as he created the child, which with the Torah already learnt. But he undoes that learning of the Torah. And we have to go and do all the mitzvahs ourselves. Why? Because we have to make those mitzvahs ours. It's not sufficient to do the mitzvah and to learn the Torah. You've got to be koneh the Torah. You've got to acquire it. It's got to become part of you. And how does it become part of you? With yegiyah. With hard, hard work. And what does yegiyah mean? If you look at the word yegiyah, it means toil, effort, and it also means stretching out, extending yourself. That's the kind of yegiyah we're talking about. Extending yourself to the limit, that's what makes a thing yours. Anybody knows that's gone running with Mark Hoffman, that when you run with Mark Hoffman, you can always run faster and further than when you run on your own. Why? Because when you run on your own, you start convincing yourself that your heart's giving in, and that you're getting weak, and that you're about to sprain your ankle, and that it's not good to overdo things, and that rather a little bit of exercise regularly than a lot of exercise not regularly, and all of a sudden you're moira het, and you get home and you think, but that's not what Mark taught me. He taught me that I've got to run 3 miles and not 1 mile. Yeah, that doesn't apply to me. Not today. There's a reason why it doesn't apply to me today. Back to the Rashi and Shavuos. It's always a question of, doesn't apply to me. Yegiyah, applying yourself to the utmost, is something you only know you've done when you're already beyond it. Until you've done it, you never know that you're at your excesses, that you're at the level of your limit. And what brings about the progress? Not the first mile. And not the second mile, and not the mile and a half. It's the last 10 yards that brings the progress. That's where you progress. All the rest is just to get there. All the rest is just to get as far as you got yesterday so that today you can go further. That's what it is. When you sit down and you learn a piece of Gemara, until you're really extending yourself, until the sweat starts pouring down, you're not progressing. You're just getting yourself to the point where you can make progress. And that progress will take 5 minutes. It's the last 5 minutes of your learning. What's important is not, I learned 3 hours. I didn't extend myself terribly much, but I learned the 3 hours. That's nothing. Rather learn the 5 minutes or the 10 minutes with exertion, with extending your mind, with extending your feeling, with extending your understanding to the absolute limits of its ability. And then you're making it yours. Then you're acquiring it. If there's not yegiyah, if you're not stretching out as far as you can, it's not becoming yours. And when it's not becoming yours, we're back to that Rashi in Shavuos. You and it are separate. What's the whole problem? We always ask ourselves, how can it be that a man can sit in a base of Medrash and he can learn Torah and he still can't bring in a chair for a lady when she needs one? How can it be possible? A man sitting and he's learning and learning and learning. What's he learning about? How to be a mensch? And yet it can happen that almost in the middle of his learning he doesn't even do it. How's it possible? Very simple. The learning and he are different. He's learning and the learning is taking place. He's doing and living. But what he's learning and how he's living have nothing to do with each other. What he's used to doing, he'll do. What he's been taught to do, he'll do. What he's in the habit of doing, he'll do. But to extend himself, to be moser nefesh a little bit, to put in energy and effort, that not. Why not? Doesn't apply to me. Here one begins to see the area of real avodas Hashem, the area of real progress. That you can decide that you want to give somebody a gift.
Just deciding that is already a wonderful thing. You want to respond or to create a relationship with a particular individual. So you write out a check and you send it to him. It's a wonderful thing. Now there can be two reasons that you did it. You might have done it because you want him to get something particular that he wants, or because you know he needs the money more than anything else. Or it can be because that's the easiest way and the quickest way to get the gift sent. If it's the former, as it very often is, that's a wonderful gift. If it's the latter, it's also a very fine gift. But you have someone else who doesn't do that. He phones up a florist. And he says, please put together a very nice bowl of flowers and send it to so-and-so and send me the bill. It's a bit more effort. That's already more of himself going into the gift. Then you find another person who says, oh, I want to see what they're sending. And he goes to the florist himself, and he chooses the flower, and he has it sent. Then you have a person who says, no, I want to deliver it myself. Why should they send it? Why should they have the mitzvah? I want the mitzvah. So he prepares the flowers, and he chooses the flowers, and he pays the florist, and he takes it around himself, knocks on the door, and he presents the gift. That's already a lot more effort. Then you have someone who says, flowers are very nice, but they don't need flowers. What do they need? Don't know. So he starts finding out. He puts a lot of effort into finding out what they need. He goes and he buys what they need. That's still more effort. That's you see more of a hiskashus, of a relationship between the individual and the action. It's not an action separate from the individual, it's becoming more his own action. And then finally you get the person who goes and he finds out, what do they need? They need a fruit bowl. A fruit bowl, okay. And they go and off they buy the most beautiful fruit bowl that they can find and afford. And what do? They go to the mikveh and they table it and they go home and they wrap it up and they put ribbons on it and they bring it and they say, a gift for you, ready table. That's extending yourself. That's extension. There you're doing much more than is the normal course of events. Now you think that's so far-fetched, but that's a halacha. But that's how you have to do it. What's the din on Purim? You've got to give gifts. It's one of the times when it's a chiyuv to give gifts. So let's learn the principles of gift-giving from Purim. What's the din? You've got to give food. It's got to be ready to eat. It's got to be cooked already. Don't give somebody some food that they've still got to go and cook. The whole thrill of receiving a present is being able to receive it and use it immediately. That's the most exciting moment of the present. So it says the halacha on Purim, make sure that what you give the person is something he can immediately use. Tuck into straight away. That's the mitzvah of Purim, of giving presents on Purim. And that's where we learn the dinim of giving gifts. So what I gave to you as an example, and you all laughed at something very far-fetched and outlandish, is actually halachically required. That's what being a mensch is. Going as far as you can to put in effort. When I talk about effort, I'm not talking about quantitative effort. I'm not talking about how much time you're learning. I'm not talking about how many mitzvahs you keep. I'm talking about exerting yourself in the mitzvahs you're doing. It might be one mitzvah. It might be 10 mitzvahs. It might be 613 mitzvahs. Whatever it is. But in each mitzvah, taking it as far as you possibly can. That's avodas Hashem, and that's how there's progress. And when that isn't occurring, progress is not taking place. It's as simple as that. The Telzerov, in describing the relationship of quality to quantity, gives basically the following illustration. You might think, okay, so what's the difference? So I did table the gift, I didn't table the gift. What's the difference? Look at what the difference is. If you didn't table the gift, you've given a nice gift, and the person owes you a thank you, and you've established a nice relationship, and it's very nice and fine and wonderful. Derech Eretz, it's covered, it's all sorts of wonderful mitzvahs. But it hasn't done anything for you, because we've now established the principle that in order for something to do something for you, it requires yegiah, it requires extending yourself. So the mitzvah is done, but it hasn't been done to you. The same as Averus, it's that same Rashi. I'm prepared to do the Averus, but I don't believe that I'm prepared to do the mitzvahs, but I don't believe that a mitzvah can really affect me. That's what we're really saying. Because if you knew how a mitzvah could affect you, you wouldn't stop at taking it to the mikveh. You would do whatever else you could dream up doing. If you knew how that mitzvah could affect you, and every little millimeter you extend yourself further, what effect it's having on you, there would be no question. But why don't we exert ourselves? Because we don't really believe that mitzvahs have any effect on us. That's what it is. The example, or a similar example to that which the Telzerov gives, is the following. You talk about an inch of rain fell last night. An inch of rain? How much is an inch? This much rain? What's the good of that? An inch of rain is a fortune, because what it means is an inch of rain fell over a huge area. Now, says he, imagine you've got the floor covered with one layer of peanuts, and assume that you love peanuts. And now you have the option of increasing that layer 1 inch further or 1 inch higher. It's an inch. That's completely different. 1 inch higher, you're getting double. 1 inch further, you're getting an extra inch. Says the Telzer Rov, when there's a quantitative increase in your avodas Hashem, it affects everything else you're doing. When you've affected yourself and you're not the same person, your Kriya Shema is not the same, and your davening is not the same, and your relationship with your wife is not the same, and your relationship with your children and your parents is not the same, and your relationship with other people is not the same, your Yom Kippur is not the same, your Sukkot is not the same, your Lulav is not the same, your Esrei is not the same, you don't speak the same, you don't walk the same, you don't do business the same. Everything's changed because of that 1 millimeter of progress, provided it's qualitative progress. And you know how eager we are to make quantitative progress. There's a lesson to be learned in that. We're eager to make quantitative progress. We want another peanut, another square inch covered. It's good, it should be, the whole floor should be covered with peanuts. But that's nothing compared to covering it 1 inch further, is nothing compared to a tenth of an inch higher. Can you imagine what you've got there? But there we don't really believe we're capable of covering the floor higher. That's the problem. We don't understand the effect of these things on us. And now we see, it's not just a question of, I tabled the gift before I gave it to them. Very nice, it was a nice chesed. It wasn't a nice chesed, that's missing the point. It was a very nice chesed. But the important thing is that you extended yourself as far as you could go. That means you're a different person from today. You're just not the same person anymore. The mitzvah of chesed has affected you. And now everything you do is different. That's incredible progress. If only we would believe and understand what exertion can do. And again, I'm not talking about physical exertion, I'm not talking about quantitative exertion. All I'm suggesting is the things that we do properly. So it comes to having a guest at your table. Tzachnosis Orchim, sure it is. So you give him, serve him a nice dish of food. It's chesed, it's tzachnosis Orchim, it's wonderful, it's mitzvah. Doesn't do anything for you. Unless you're taking that mitzvah as far as you possibly can. You get up and about him, and you're attending to him, and you talk to him, and you try and make him feel comfortable. So that by the time you're finished with that mitzvah, you're emotionally drained. When he leaves your table, you have to take a breath outside and walk around and recover yourself and lie down for half an hour because you've put such effort into the mitzvah. Then you've been affected by Hachnasas Ochim. And then there's progress, then there's moving forward because you believe that what you learn in the Beis HaMedrash has to be practiced to the full in the world and that has an effect on you. Now, assuming you're not sure, because this is the area of Aveiro now. We're not talking about quantitative Aveiro. We're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu Alav HaSholem and Yaakov HaTzadik. We're talking about all sorts of fantastic people. So we're not talking about quantitative Aveiros. We're not worried that Chas V'Shalom Moshe forgot to say Kriya Shema one morning, or he didn't put on tefillin, or he talked Lashon Hora. We're not worried about that kind of thing at all. Because even if he did do such a thing, he would have done tshuva long ago. What we're worried about is that maybe there was an intellectual mistake, meaning that for a moment he didn't fully realize the extent to which his mitzvahs affect him, and therefore he didn't exert himself to the full. And can you imagine if you're sitting writing an exam and somebody whispered in your ear, one bit more effort and you're through? And it would be difficult to put the more effort in. If we believe that one little bit more effort changes our lives, would it be difficult to put that effort in? But we don't believe. So what we're worried about here is that maybe for a moment, Moshe Rabbeinu says, I didn't fully appreciate the extent to which this mitzvah could affect me, and therefore I didn't exert myself to the full. Okay, terrible thing, but I did the mitzvah. I said Kriya Shema, but I didn't say it with all the kavon that I had. It is a terrible thing. Because as a result of that, you're 1 millimeter lower. That means everything, Moshe Rabbeinu, you've ever done in your life is 1 millimeter lower. And that's an awful lot of millimeters. When you look at the lifespan of Moshe Rabbeinu and the richness of life of Moshe Rabbeinu, you're saying everything you could have done, if you only said that one Kriya Shema with all your strength and with all your might, that would have changed you a little bit, it would have made you a little bit bigger, and consequently everything you did would have been a little bit more effective and a little bit more righteous. That's something to worry about. In other words, the major area of concern in our mitzvahs and our averos is not so much the quantity. Quantity can be easily repaired. It's, did I exert myself in the things I did, in the Gemara I learned, in the Shiurim I attended, in the mitzvahs I did I do them with all I've got? Because if I didn't, that's hard tshuva to do. In fact, it's almost impossible. Because if you didn't, it means you didn't fully appreciate the extent that those mitzvahs and averas can affect you and could affect you. we see this finally right at the end of the Sedra in a strange word. What we're saying is that in everything you do, you've got to do it to the full. What about passive things that happen to you? Sometimes we're chetzer, sometimes we're passive. Things just happen. But there's nothing that happens in one's life that isn't an opportunity to grow, because that's what we put here. Every moment of your life is opportunity to grow, bigger and bigger and bigger, and greater and greater and greater. What about the passive things? Well, an example of the most passive thing that I can imagine is dying. Nobody wants it. Nobody plays any part in achieving it. It's the one thing you try not to do. So the last thing one does in one's life is the most passive of all of them. And yet in the Sedra, God tells Moshe, Alei al har ha'avorim azeh, go onto the mountain, etc. Umut bahar ashiratoy leshama, and die there. A tzivui, a commandment. Go up there and die. Don't commit suicide. You're not allowed to kill yourself, but I'm commanding you to die. Very, very strange. Says the Sipur, no. Umut bahar. Kabel alecho hamiso lechaporo al asher me'altem. Accept upon yourself the death as kaporo. We defined what kaporo was earlier this afternoon, as atonement for having disobeyed me. That means you have to say, Moshe Rabbeinu, hineni mechavim b'zeh, I hereby have the intention to be yotze, the din of kaporo, by my death. And then lie down and die. What does that mean? That even in something as passive as dying, one can take an attitude which is active. The way you relate to it is active. Do you know what strength it must have taken? All the thoughts on Moshe's mind at that moment. What's going to happen to the people? Will Yeshua manage his own children, his own family? The fact that he hasn't managed to get into Eretz Yisrael finally. So many thoughts to go through his mind. And he's got to stop just before he dies and have full intention and full kavona. And you know how difficult it is to have kavona. It's difficult to concentrate in a shir. It's difficult to concentrate when you're learning yourself. It's difficult to concentrate in davening. But to concentrate in dying, it must be virtually impossible. But it's a tzivui. He has to do that. Extend yourself, Moshe, to the last moment of your life. Even the act of dying, which is the most passive thing you've ever done in your life, is mus. It's a tzivui. You've got to do it actively. And the way you do it actively is by the attitude you take to it and the angle you take to it. So that even in something as passive as death, since Moshe was able to extend himself to the full, he was able to grow through it. It's only tragic that the man who worries is the man who least needs to worry. But the man who started off addressing Shamayim V'Oretz because he didn't know where he was going to go, he was worried that in spite of having kept all the mitzvahs and doing none of the averos, and having done tshuva for anything he did do wrong, and giving his life for the one avero he did do, he was still worried that maybe because of a lack of exertion, he wouldn't go to heaven. That was the fear of Moshe. And God says to him, don't be silly. Your place is right under my throne. Moshe Rabbeinu, the one who least needs to worry about it, is the one who has nightmares about it. We go to sleep peacefully, and we go through our Yom Kippur happily, and we break our fast happily, in the full assumption that the Ribbono Shel Olam will have chesed and rachamim.